Hello and welcome back to the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast, brought to you in partnership with FootJoy. Today on the episode, we've got Gil Hance to talk about our recent trip to America, Hopi Match Club, and Le Bourde that we visited last year. This is the second time we've got Gil on the podcast. We talked to him about Castle Stewart a couple of years ago, and it was great to catch up with Gil again and talk about his partnership with Jim Wagner and the decisions they made at a Hopi Match Club and Le Bourde, really. I mean, a Hopi Match Club being a match club and explicitly playing match play allowed them to be really bold with the way that they designed the course. And we talked to him about that, the whiskey routing, and then went on to the new course of Le Bourde, which has just broken into the world top 100. So it's a fascinating chat with Gil. He's so insightful. He's probably one of the hottest architects in the world right now. So please sit back and enjoy.
Watch this.
And we also had a great time out in a Hoopy in January for the New Year's foursomes with Colin Sheehan. I don't know how we managed to get ourselves on that invite, but anyway.
I was half expecting you to be there, Gil.
Yeah, I was supposed to be in Sydney. We declined because usually Jim Wagner and I play together in that. And if you'll notice, well, I don't know if they show you on the trophy, my name's the first year.
I had a
very, very accomplished partner. I put Zach Blair, a tour pro, in places a tour player would never, ever go on his own devices. And instead of being upset, he had like the greatest attitudes, like, watch this. This is going to be great. And then I putted great. So we were a formidable team. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It's always good to win the inaugural event of anything, I think. That's not speaking from experience, by the way, but it would be good to win an inaugural event.
Yeah, so I was supposed to be down in Sydney right at the new year, and things got delayed here a little bit with permitting. So it wound up I was in the States, but you know, by that point in time, we'd already said no. But it's a very fun event, and the fact that the weather can be very unpredictable is I think a wonderful part of the equation as well.
Just think, for us, it was the first time we'd ever seen dormant Bermuda, and we've been going on about it like crazy, but very, very interesting surface.
Yeah, it is. It's great. I mean, it's as fescue-y as you can get Bermuda grass, right? I mean, it's tight and it's firm and the ball bounces and you can pick it off of it and play all these kind of wonderful shots. And Rhett Baker, the superintendent, does an amazing job managing it. And it's nice from the membership standpoint is you've got, you know, within one season, you're going to have multiple golf courses, right? It's going to be very lush and not lush. It's never lush because of the sand, but, you know, basically beautiful green and then goes dormant and then can come back and then go dormant again, just based on the weather, and then wraps up, you know, in prime growing season. So it's a fun golf course. And when Jim and I laid it out, we talked a lot about the ground game and that dormant Bermuda, the ability to actually hit ground shots on Bermuda, which is not very common.
We did our wrap up podcast with the other person who traveled with us from the UK. So a chap called Ryan Nodes, who's the managing director at the Addington, which you might be familiar with as a sort of Abercrombie course going through a massive restoration. And I mean, he's right in the weeds of it, every aspect. And he's talking a lot about Bermuda, and he was saying, you know, he's got a bit of a love affair going with Bermuda. And he's really sort of into the detail, but he was saying how the strains that we're using now on the sort of high end of Bermuda is actually really... it's incredible the way it performs. And you see that because when you're sort of coming in from under 100 yards, it's really hard to get any grab on the ball. So it does create that sort of really fast running playing condition, doesn't it? That I suppose is quite hard to achieve in the States.
Yeah, it does. And because so much of the recent golf development's been in, you know, the Southwest or the Southeast or the Southern part of the United States, there's been so much of an emphasis on doing the right thing environmentally and having warm season grasses, but, you know, working hard to get them to a place where they're performing like cool season grasses, like the ones we love. They get a much finer texture. The green surfaces are arguably as good, if not better, than bent surfaces. I mean, it's terrific what they've done with Bermuda grass, and they keep coming out with new stuff. It's like every, you know, we were the first ones to use Tif Tuff at a Hoopy on a golf course setting, and now we've used it 3 or 4 times, but now there's another generation of grasses coming. The turf grass industry is phenomenal at responding to environmental factors, but also the fact that they're drought tolerant means that you can get them bouncy and bumpy, which you never could before. with Bermuda.
What's the dominant strain in, so you're spending the winter in Australia, so that'll be, I'm guessing this is Royal Sydney and the work there that's,
yes.
That's a big piece of work, right? How's all that going? And you know, what is the dominant strain of grass that you're working with down there?
So it's going great. It's all sand. The scale of the golf course is coming into focus now with, you know, a little bit of tree removal, and just the contours are really flowing nicely. And we're about five holes shaped, and you know, I think we're feeling really good about it. We've got Josh McFadden here running the project for us, and Reese Haspel and Rory, all two young Scots here working. So we've got a great team, and everybody's enthused about what we're doing, which is cool. So the grasses we're using, well, they call Bermuda cooch grass. So it's okay. Cooch in the fairways. I think it's Santa Ana, if I'm correct on that. And then the greens are bent. So you're going to pure distinction, which is, you know, a U.S. bred grass. So Adam Marchant, the golf course superintendent, has been very involved in doing all the research. He's been to the States a bunch to check on grasses. So he's pretty excited about the combination of the two.
So how's your time looking in Australia? Are you going to be out there for a couple more months, or how's that all looking?
Yeah, we've been here about a month, and we're getting, I'm here, Tracy's with me till the 9th of March. And then we go back, okay. And hopefully by then the snow will have melted in Springfield, New Jersey, and New Haven, Connecticut. So we're right straight into the upper course at Baltusrol and then Yale University's golf course. Those are big projects I need to get back to the States for.
Does Gil Hans get any holiday, or is it just work 365?
No, we're actually, Tracy has a birthday coming up next week, and we're taking off and going to Queenstown, New Zealand for about 5 days. So we do, a lot of times they're working holidays. This one, she made me promise to leave the golf clubs and no golf course visits. So we're just going to spend some time in nature and hike and take a little bit of time off.
Queenstown's famous for its bungee jumping. Are you going to be getting
more bungee? That's not happening. No.
That's one of my questions, though, is thinking about this stuff, because, you know, it's great that you're traveling together, because that would just put an inordinate amount of strain on a relationship being away. But when you look at the, not just the amount of projects you've got going on, Gil, but also the spread of where they are, I find it hard to imagine. It must be quite tough to just every level. Like, you know, you have to be on the move so much. Then I suppose I'm quite curious from a professional standpoint, it's quite hard to compartmentalize all those different projects and then turn up with your best self when you've just been deeply invested in the process at Royal Sydney to then go over to whether it's Yale or Baltusrol or whatever, and then sort of think, right, I now need to almost flip my head into this project now for a sustained period of time.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the way we've chosen to do business for 30 years. And, you know, Jim and I both understand and believe that we need to be on site to produce the best possible results. So it's, you know, I'm so fortunate that he's been my partner for all those years. And when I'm not on a site, he's generally on it. So we get coverage, and then we've got, you know, a ton of great guys working for us. I mean, without them, this doesn't work, right? I mean, you just pointed out, I can't be in more than one place at one time. And so, we feel good about the fact that somebody like Josh McFadden, CEO, we've got Neil Cameron, Seamus Maley. I mean, there's so many shapers. And then in our office, we've got Ben Hillard and Kevin Murphy, and Russ Myers just joined us. You know, he's the superintendent at LACC and Southern Hills. And so we've built a really, what we feel is a really strong team. And so we always have presence. There's always somebody from our company on site to make whatever decisions. And Jim and I are the ones that are just constantly bouncing from job to job. And the fact that we're here has been great, because it's literally, I can't go anywhere else, right? I can't, if it's raining today in Sydney, I can't say, all right, well, I'm going to change my schedule and fly to Florida and work down there. Or, you know, in the US, it's constantly, people always say, oh, you know, we can never pin you down. And that's because our schedule is based on weather. Right. I mean, we can't waste days. So if it's snowing in New Haven, I'm not going to sit at home and wait for the snow to melt. I'm going to go to Florida. But here, it's been 2 months, or will be 2 months, of just focus on this project. And it's been refreshing and energizing and exciting. And you mentioned the sort of moving from place to place. And job to job, and you know, Rainer McDonald to Tillinghast to our own stuff here, that's what keeps you from getting burned out. That's what makes things fresh. There's always, it's like your mind is constantly moving in different directions. And for whatever reason, Jim and I have been able to adapt to that over time and enjoy it. And it really, you know, we've had, touch wood, you know, an amazing sort of last 12 years where we haven't stopped. And it's been that fresh perspective on all these wonderful opportunities we've been a part of that just keeps you going and recharges your batteries and gets you excited about the, you know, where you're headed next.
Do you find when you're going from, you know, the two different strains of what you do really is new build courses and your restoration / renovation, do you find they bring different challenges in terms of trying to be sympathetic with the environment and trying to be sympathetic with the original build versus trying to be creative? And how does that all sort of work when you come to practice?
Yeah, I think the new courses are obviously, it's just creativity. There's changes that are going to occur. And you probably have more flexibility in doing that as opposed to, you know, if our goal, which it always is to come into an old club or course and restore Tillinghast or Ross or whoever, we're pretty much know what we're going to do. We can't just say, hey, you know, I just had a great idea last night while I was thinking about this, and we're going to change that green to something else or move bunkers around, which we obviously have the flexibility and the freedom to do in our own work. But when we're talking about a restoration, we're really kind of, we know what we're setting out to do. And there can be some wonderful efficiencies in that, you know, you're not blowing up stuff and doing it again, although it's our time if we have to reshape something. You're generally speaking on a much tighter time frame in a restoration because somebody's course is out of commission. So you're trying to do it in a fashion where you're hitting grassing windows and enabling the club to get back open again. So those projects tend to be much more streamlined and organized. The new builds, I mean, we're still very, very efficient at it. We don't want to waste anyone's time or money, but we can jump all around the property if we need to. Mm. And we can kind of go, you know what, I had a better idea for that hole. I'm going to go over there and work right now. Whereas restoration, renovation tends to be much more sequenced. It's like, okay, well, I don't have any new ideas because we know what we're doing on that hole because that's what Ross built. So we're just going to stick to the sequence.
This is going wildly off topic and not why we've got you on, but I have a habit of doing this, and it's interesting while I've got a world leader in the room. Often with sort of these restoration renovation jobs, it's about future proofing because the players are getting longer. They're sort of out overpowering golf courses. This rollback announcement, does that have a wide effect to your field? Is that going to change the way that you operate in the next 5-10 years, do you think?
I don't think so. And firstly, I applaud what the RNA and the USGA have done. I think it's about time that we got something done. There's all kinds of people can argue all different sides of the perspective that, you know, what they did was enough, not enough, et cetera, but at least they did something. I applaud them. And I think that was great. It was a great step because, you know, as we look at these projects, nobody really talks a lot about the environmental aspect or the management aspect or, you know, adding all this yardage and adding these tees and constantly moving the target on golf courses. I think that might slow down a little bit, but I believe by the time 28 comes around, the manufacturers, the athletes, they're all going to have figured out, you know, maybe we're not going to make the gains that we've made over the last 6 years. Maybe the gains will be incrementally slower, which I hope. But I'm not sure that this is going to put the brakes on it, that we're going to all of a sudden start closing in back tees. So I think having been fortunate to work on some championship golf courses where this is obviously front and center, the ones we're currently working on are their championships are before 28. But, you know, we've got a couple that are after 28 and none of them have asked us to come in and you know, close tees or make any changes. So I think there's a big wait and see at this point in time.
I mean, I suppose, you know, you've done a really good job, haven't you, with the recent major venues and, you know, I suppose things like LACC felt like really proud moments, you know, and looking at the way that all came together, because it's very different. I suppose to an extent, it's it's not easy to restore, but I suppose if you're restoring for the eight handicapper, you don't really have to think about the elite player so much. But when you've got the world's best players queuing up to play, that must bring a very different dynamic to it, because you've got one stakeholder in the room that, you know, this is a really important competition, and therefore scoring and the champion it produces is key. But you also know you're holding, you know, a George Thomas masterpiece in your hands, and you're thinking, I can't push it to the point just to focus on score. So that must be quite hard to be sat in between those two. I'm not saying they're conflicting, because I'm sure the USGA won the best for the championship, but and the best for the course. But you get what I mean, right?
Yeah, I do, and I think that that's the one thing that Jim and I have learned over the time that we've been doing this is we've got to trust George Thomas. We've got to trust Ross, Tillinghast, whoever happened to be the original architect, you know, Phones at Oakmont, that what they did was good enough to challenge the best players in the world and still remains good enough, meaning strategy, slopes and greens, expanded greens to recapture, find new hole locations, just the way the ground tilts. Everything within the bones of what they built is good enough. We don't need to go in and put our fingerprints all over it. Now, that's not to say that we don't add tees and we don't sometimes shift bunkers downrange, but we do so in a sympathetic way. As like if Tillinghast had a bunker guarding the right side of the fairway and it's no longer relevant, and we can move that bunker where it's relevant for the tour player, either by adding a back tee or shifting the bunker, we're not going to add one on the left just because we think that's great from a championship perspective. We're going to stick with Tillinghast only had one on the right, and we're going to go down that road. And that's where the trust comes in, that these guys understood how to defend golf courses. And at its core, I mean, the way they do it has changed dramatically in the implements they have and the athleticism and everything, the way they optimize their equipment from, you know, when players played in the 20s and 30s. But at its core, the game of golf is still the same. Mm. And the way to defend it and protect it is still the same. It's just measures of how you do it. And because, you know, the great equalizer as it relates to these great old courses are slopes and greens, because they, you know, you get them fast and the slopes are magnified dramatically. And so, you know, it challenges them greatly on the greens, and then it's rough. You know, it's the ability to grow rough if the golf course originally had it. Like our approach at Wingfoot and Oakmont is completely different than our approach at LACC, where we saw the widest fair, you know, some of the widest fairways in U.S. Open history, but it related directly to George Thomas's design and angles and approaches. And, you know, if you go with narrow fairways, you're not going to set up the angles. You can't, because, you know, players are coming out of the rough. So I think there are ways to do this, to make sure you check the boxes as far as length, but at its core, the values and the principles that those guys brought to their design and the implementation of it from the 20s and 30s proves in this day and age, because of slope, et cetera, to be enough of a challenge for these guys.
You talked there about how the slopes of a green can be magnified by green speeds, essentially. When you're designing a course, do you design it with an ideal speed in mind? I think if this runs at this is how I want to play.
No, unless the client really has strong feelings about it. Like I'll give you an example. You know, Boston Golf Club is one of our earliest golf courses, and John Minnick and Rob Ketterson were the founders of that club. And John and Rob were both, they loved old greens. They loved big rolls and slopes and just, you know, interesting greens. And they said, listen, we want you to build greens as if they might have existed at Myopia or Pine Valley or places like that. We'll manage the green speeds, right? We'll keep them at 9. We won't ever let them get above 9 or 10. And we just want to have fun, and we want the greens to be built that way. Well, tragically, in John's case, he's no longer alive, and Rob is not that involved at the club. And so you had the two founders are now not there, and the membership, and I'm not saying they're wrong. Their thoughts are, well, we want to be competitive with all the clubs in the greater Boston area, and all the clubs in the greater Boston area have their greens rolling at 11 or 12 on the stimp meter. And we don't want to come in and have ours at 9.5 and 10, even though the architecture was designed for that. So we've gone in over the last 3 years and made modifications to all the greens, because just at today's modern speeds, they're too there was too much contour. So it happens that you basically take your directive from the client sometimes, and then ultimately sometimes that changes. But Jim and I have always thought that if you're looking at, you know, if I ask the two of you guys what your favorite green, I am actually going to ask you, I'll give you a second to think about it while I finish answering the question. But, you know, if you ask what are your favorite greens, most people in the world are going to say Augusta, Pinehurst, Sunningdale. You know, they're going to pick a golden age golf course. They're not going to pick something modern. So if we hold that to be the standard of greatness, why wouldn't we want to be designing greens that are similar in slope? Mm. I'm not saying they have to be as bold or as daring, but why wouldn't we want to create greens that, at least from a slope standpoint, as long as we provide enough opportunities, if they get the greens, you know, 12 or 13, that there are hole locations, we feel like it's important. So we push the slope probably as far as most modern architects do. So what are your favorite green complexes, guys?
I know what Sam's going to say. He's going to say his home club.
Do you know, I played at Blackwell since I was seven. Last 10 years, big appreciation for sort of Tom Simpson. And because it's such a small piece of land, we never had the luxury of moving it around. So those greens he built in 1923 are just extraordinary. Now, going to the US a couple of weeks ago, you sit there and think, God, if we actually did get green speeds above 10, these greens would actually be, I would say there's at least five or six that would be unplayable on the golf course. And you know, I suppose I think there's a big shift over in the UK and probably the US in terms of what's an accepted speed. We were talking about Sunningdale, for example. You know, it's one of the great courses. It's always in the best condition, but very rarely you'll see the greens above 10 and a half, 11 there. And then, you know, our time in the US, I don't think we played a course that was, certainly didn't feel like it was less than 12, but I think it starts to lose meaning once you go north of that number, right?
Right.
Tom, I had a long answer, but Tom's going to provide a really pithy answer here to his favorite green complexes, I'm sure.
I don't know. I mean, we recently, on our trip to America, where we played Ahupi for the first time, we were lucky enough to play Peachtree. Recency bias is a great thing, but they're a great set of greens, you know. Small and unjuicy. Very, very similar, actually, without being ridiculously biased. Very similar to Blackwell in terms of small and undulating, which are, you know, it just poses a question, but then Peachtree got the green speeds really quick. So it's frighteningly quick. But that's the difference. But I think when the greens are really fast, there's not much you can do architecturally. I mean, we'll get onto Ahupi shortly, but I think is it the ninth, which is the drivable par four, the championship ninth?
Yes.
The green there is a fabulous green. We've talked about it on repeat on this podcast since we played it, and it's match play, so you can do whatever you like. But they were so quick and so undulating. It was frightening stuff. Frightening stuff over there.
They sort of, like, in the same way, I've said this about when we did the podcast about Peachtree, though, Gil. Like, a few months ago, I devoured The Lynx by Robert Hunter. And the bit that really stuck with me with the book was, you know, it's almost like an encyclopedia for people laying out golf courses in the golden age in the US, isn't it? And it talks so much about matching the green complexes to the holes you're playing. And I remember talking at great length about the shot that the green is going to accommodate, the contours and the severity needs to match that. So I felt at Peachtree that was like the best harmony of that you see, because I don't know whether that's because it's sort of slightly later, sort of on the lead up, you know, it's obviously Jones's last course and it's, you know, it's a couple of decades on and we're in the steel shaft era at that point when it was built, but they just beautifully match the holes, I felt, at Peachtree. I think that's a great, great call of Tom's. So, I mean, should we talk a little bit about Ahupi? I mean, that would be really cool, because I think the whole model and the brief there, I suppose the big question here is how does, you know, did that brief was front and center from day one, was it? And, you know, yes. I guess the big thing is, to what extent does designing for match play, you know, give you an ability to completely tear up the rule book?
Yeah, it was from day one. Michael Walrath, the founder there, said, I want to build a match play course. So when I go out and play golf, in his words, with my knucklehead friends, we all play matches and we love the camaraderie and the competition and the trash talk and everything about it. He said, well, if I want to create a place that is special in golf, I want it to match those characteristics and those qualities, because that's what we enjoy playing. And I think most everybody enjoys match play. So he came to us and asked us that question and said, can you do this? And we both said, absolutely. And I've used the word before, and I think Jim would use it as well. It was liberating.
Yeah.
Right. It gave us the opportunity to look at different answers and ask big questions and that require big answers to solve them. And I think, you know, we talk, if you're designing a stroke play or chance somebody's going to write down a score and they've taken an eight and then they're, you know, they may say that's a terrible hole and Gil Hans is a terrible architect and they might be right. But, you know, at match play, you've just lost the hole, right? You move on. You haven't just destroyed your round and said, oh, now there's no chance I'm going to shoot 70 or 80 or whatever because the golf hole just, you know, I just put an eight on my scorecard. And so we thought with that mindset, we could do something. You know, we're all devotees of the strategic school of architecture. We think, you know, that's risk reward, blah, 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 is really the way to design courses. And we hear about the penal school of architecture where it's just penalize everything that's wayward. And then, you know, there was a heroic school of architecture that people used to talk about where, you know, it was strategic on steroids, lack of a better way to describe it. And I think that's what we talked about at Ahupi is say, listen, let's ask big questions. And if you want to try and answer a big question, then based on the status of your match, you're going to have the opportunity to do it. If you're two down, you got to start pressing. And you got to start taking risks. And as long as the risks yield big rewards, go ahead. And if you're two up, you might be like, yeah, no, I'm not taking that on. I'm going to play safely over here. And so, you know, width, there's angles, there's different ways to attack golf holes. And there are a lot of half par holes out there. You know, not only literally on the scorecard is a 3.5, but in concept, you know, a lot of short par fours, short five, long five. So, I mean, there's long fours. You know, so there's 4.5s and 5.5s, et cetera. So it's not just always, you know, 3.5s or 4.5s for a par fives. So I think from that standpoint, it was exciting. The topography and the land worked perfectly for us. You know, we talked earlier about the dormant Bermuda, the ability to hit ground shots in southern part of the United States is not something that's terribly common. So the fact that we've got 60 feet of sand underneath it, Jim and I worked the contours to try to inspire people to try ground shots. And I think one of the great things, as I mentioned earlier, you know, is the recovery options at Ahupi. And recovery is such a huge part of match play because not even tour players hit every fairway in regulation. And so when you have the opportunity to hit really heroic recoveries or to play safely, which might be smarter, it's the whole mindset of how you attack a golf course. And what we tried to do was give you every opportunity to play aggressively or conservatively, depending on your mindset, the way you're playing that day and the way your match stands. And that was a fascinating exercise for us. It really was.
Do you remember walking around the site the first time?
Yes, it was actually before Michael. So Jim and I had been on that site back in 2006 or 2007.
Really?
We were going to build a golf course with Davis Love on that site. And then the financial collapse happened and everything kind of fell apart. And so Michael Walrath, once he decided he wanted to work with us on this project, he would send me photos of, you know, red clay sites in Georgia. He picked Georgia because kind of a but a good stopping off point between Florida and New York. And kept saying, no, that's not right. You want sand. And then I said, Jim and I were talking about it. We said, remember that site? So I said, Michael, we saw this site years ago. Don't know what happened to it. I'm assuming a bank owns it right now. But if you can go here and see this, then you'll know exactly what we're talking about. And to Michael's credit, he went there right away. And I'll never forget the text he sent me. It said, I see what you mean. And within 24 hours, he had locked it up. So, it's great to work with people who are that devoted and passionate about what they're trying to do and then have the resources to do it.
Was the Davis Love course quite as out there?
No, it was different. There was a real estate development with it. There was a racetrack, which you guys probably played. You played the whiskey routing, the A-hole.
Yeah.
So, there's a funny story, Jim. So, when we got to the end and we figured out and we knew we wanted to add these holes and Jim, we knew that was the part of the property we wanted to be in, but we couldn't quite figure out how to link it all together. And Jim came up with the idea of crossing over. So, you know, the D hole crosses over 10. So that was great. Michael was all in on saying, yeah, that sounds great. So Ben Hillard and Seamus Maley were our two like lead guys on the project down there. And so we knew there were four holes. I took one, Jim took one, Ben took one, and Seamus took one. And we all just kind of went into our cocoons and designed and built these holes on our own until we needed, you know, help. And everybody kind of came to help finish them off. And so as we're doing this, you know, Jim being Jim, he goes, listen, I know you're never going to name a hole after me, so I'm going to do it myself. I'm taking the eight hole. And so that was, that's where it all came from. So Jim got eight. I'm not going to tell you where the others are, but it was a very fun exercise. And it was part of that. Old golf architects talk a lot about like a sense of humor in golf architecture, a sense of whimsy. And I think we approached those four holes with a sense of whimsy. It was just, hey, let's build stuff that we probably would never dare to do anywhere else or on any other setting. And let's just have some fun with it.
I think the A on whiskey is quite easily one of the most ridiculous greens I've ever seen. I'm sure it's a popular pin, but we had a pin back right, you know, in that little nook that comes off. It's very, very crazy.
Yeah, but it is. And it's again,
great luxury. Yeah. You can do that, can't you? You know, you're not going to play a US Open at a Hoopy, or not that I'm aware of. So you can create something that's just purely about, you know, tapping into the, I suppose, the inner child of the golfer, really.
Yes, 100%. And that's exactly what we're trying to do there.
One thing that stuck with me at the Hoopy is that I think I'm going to get the numbers wrong here in terms of how many, but obviously you play, there's 22 holes on the property. You play 2, 3, 4, and 5 are on the championship, and there's A, B, C, and D. For those who haven't played a Hoopy, I'm sure that's confused our listeners no end. However, what that means, I think, is does that mean you play to 14 greens on both routings? I might have got that wrong. And a large number of those are greens that you play from completely different tee boxes. Not different tee boxes in the sense of match play, but I'm thinking about when you reconnect in with the championship, for example, after the D hole. Was it really difficult to make those greens multi-purpose so that hole I'm talking about, which I'm going to get the numbers wrong now, because
it's 11. It's 11.
That's a 550 yard par 5 on the championship, but then you play it as a sort of a 280, 320 par 4. Is that radically difficult? So is that really challenging to build those greens so that they can work in both settings, or?
No, because we honestly didn't give it much thought. To be perfectly honest, it was more, we wanted to make sure they worked for the championship routing. And then when we got into, we didn't go in and modify it once we figured out because those holes were built. Once we finally, because we kind of wrapped up in that corner of the property, and we kind of got to the place where when Jim figured out how to do the crossover and then play 11 as a drivable 4 versus, you know, the par 5. So it all worked out that, and then we started with the concept of like 13 is the long par 3, but in the whiskey routing, it's a short par 4. And 14 is a short par 4, and in the whiskey rounding, it plays as a par 3. So there's a lot of these different things mixed in, but because of that sort of whimsical nature of the whiskey rounding, we weren't overly concerned. I mean, I think, modestly speaking, I think they still work, but it wasn't part of our mindset of, hey, we've got to build this green for two very different golf holes, because I think without exception, almost all of those holes were built before we figured out exactly what we were doing with the whiskey.
When did the idea of the additional holes come into the build then? If you finished 18, was it always part of the plan, or?
It came in about, I would say, 2 or 3 months into the project, into the construction. Will Smith, who's not the rapper, but you know, who's with the Outpost Club and working in a National Links Trust in Washington, D.C., and was a shaper, very involved in golf construction. He was there, played a really good role. He was actually kind of a bit of a devil's advocate for Jim and I, and he would kind of poke and prod and question ideas and thoughts. And he was saying at one point in time, listen, we all love the concept of coming here and playing 36 holes a day, but walking on this sand, even if you're fit and young, which some of the members are fit and older, it's a challenge. And so what if we built something that, you know, we could use as sort of an afternoon round? And that's what we started calling it, was the afternoon round. And it started off really with more of a grouping of par three holes, kind of between 6 and 18 over in that area. And then it expanded to, well, we don't have to do par threes. We could do a couple versions of different holes. And then it shifted to where the four holes are now. But the original was sort of A, B, and then C and D came back to the 10th green. And then you jumped into 11, which, again, I apologize to those people who are listening who don't, this doesn't make any sense. But anyway, but then Jim came up with the crossover. So there were various iterations of what these four holes would look like that just kept going along. We just kept saying, hey, we've got time to figure this out. We don't have to figure this out right now because we know where the original 18 are. Let's just get those done. And as we get to the end, we'll figure out where the other four holes go, which is kind of our process. I mean, we like, there's a lot of just kind of working our way through a golf course project. It's, you know, there's a lot of conversation and obviously we're responsible to the client, but things change. And we have the best clients are willing to embrace and get excited about those changes.
Pretty much all your developments now. So I suppose I'm picking up in the field would be the saying, right? You know, I suppose that liberty to sort of move around with things when you see them kind of in the flesh. Pretty much everything you're working on now as a construction will be, there's a huge amount in the field, right? Very rarely you're building anything straight off plan and kind of moving things.
Yeah, even the restoration stuff. And I think, you know, what we pride ourselves on is trying to get those details right. Like, we know what the shape of a bunker is going to look like, what the depth of the bunker is going to look like based on historical photos. But the things you can't see in those photos or frequently you can't see is, how did the tie-ins work to the greens? How do they flow? What do the faces of those bunkers actually look like? Do they have movement? Are they square? And so I think a lot of that research and a lot of that subtlety and detail is what replaces the freedom and / creativity in new builds, is okay, as a slavish attention to detail and getting everything to feel like it fits and ties in based on whatever we have, either from documentation and restorations or intuitively we feel this is the way this bunker should tie into the screen.
We're going to have to apologize because we've not played a million Gilhan's golf courses. We've only played a few. But another one we've done recently, which I suppose would have posed a very different question, is the new Le Bord, which, congratulations, straight into the World Top 100. It's a fabulous golf course. Do you remember visiting that site for the first time and walking around that land and being down there?
Yes. Yeah, we I do. It was a lovely invitation with Driss, the owner. And I went down there and they had the best, it's hard to beat when you're going to chateaus and then they take you on a little boat ride down the Loire River with wine and cheese. It was like, it was the nicest courtship I think we've ever had as it relates to building a golf course. And what struck us instantly, because there was a golf course there, which was what made the permitting feasible, right? It's not easy to build a golf course in France. The golf course had been abandoned. It was basically the woods had grown over it, but at some point in time there was a golf course there. And our golf course is completely different. I don't want anybody to think we just built what was there before, but so some of the corridors were already prescribed, but the vegetation that had filled in over all the years it was closed was, broom and some heather and just, some beautiful stuff that instantly just looked like golf course material, fescues. And just, we thought we could visualize the palette of what the golf course would look like. We could visualize the topography. We knew it would be tree lined, but it was exciting because, Jim and I have always been very influenced by, Jim growing up in Philadelphia, I've lived there for 30 years. Marion and Pine Valley. And so that palette of plant material, the Scotch broom at Marion, the scrub and the sand, et cetera, at Pine Valley, has always been sort of the standard that we always, if it pops into our head first, that's what a golf course looks like to us. And so we saw that at Le Bord. We saw the vegetation, we saw the sand, we saw everything that would indicate to us that we could carve something into this landscape that would aesthetically be appealing to us and hopefully to everybody else. And then once we went through the courtship and we were brought onto the team, we started thinking, all right, what can we do differently that we've never done before, right? We've got the palette. We know we want what we want it to look like. And we focused in on Sam's hero, Tom Simpson. Mm-hmm. And we just said, hey, you know, we've never done a Tom Simpson restoration. I don't know if we ever will, but we've never tried to kind of look at his work as an inspiration. And so obviously with Morfontaine and with Chantilly, we had the opportunity to go and study his work and really look at it and take in bunker patterns. And, you know, obviously the architectural side of golf is my favorite architecture book. I've loved that book ever since the beginning. And a lot of it's, you know, whether it's words, Simpson's words, but Simpson's drawings are beautiful. I mean, the way he presents golf courses is, aside from Harry Rowntree, I think they're the best images for golf courses. So there was something about Tom Simpson that we'd never tapped into and that we really were excited to do. So I think the combination of the palette, the landscape, the commitment from ownership, you know, the foundation of the club, the buildings, everything that was there, and then understanding or trying to appreciate Tom Simpson's architecture. But I think one of the great resources for Le Bord is that they have the Von Hagi golf course, which is of an era, you know, from the 1980s, and it's very, very highly regarded, but it is the antithesis of what we built. And I'm not saying that's a negative. I mean, because it's strategic, it's interesting, but it's hard and it's penal hard. And it's artificial and it's, you know, water hazards everywhere and mounds and railroad ties. And it's, like you said, it's of an era. But there are very few clubs in the world that can be able to present such a variety in 36 holes to their membership. And there are devotees of the old, there are devotees of the new, but to come there and be there and to be able to play, you know, a golf course that was from the stadium era of the 1980s and still, you know, presented in a great way. And then to come and play a modern sort of homage to Heathland, golden age golf course architect, I think it's really a wonderful combination.
Were you aware of the reputation of the old so much been over in the US? Over in the UK, it had this mythical reputation for the honors board if you broke 80 and the three members, you know, that used to play there. And there's this huge sort of mystique around the whole place. Were you sort of very aware of that going in?
No, I'm being perfectly honest. I knew it because it was ranked, but I came to appreciate and understand the mythical qualities to it and the ownership structure of Baron Beek and just all of the things that went along and that board, which is kind of, you know, the exact opposite of what we believe about golf. I mean, they were celebrating how difficult it was to, you know, play that golf course well. And we're much more of the opinion that we want to celebrate fun and let people go out and play golf without losing a million balls. But there are people who love that challenge. You know, there are people whose mindset is just, hey, this is the monster. I'm going to beat the monster. And whether they do or not is up, but they like that versus what we prefer is a much more friendly stroll in a beautiful landscape with hopefully some interesting, compelling questions asked with the golf course.
You mentioned earlier on that you took inspiration from Tom Simpson. What specific, is there any examples you can give in terms of the Simpson design that you kind of took ideas from?
I think the ninth hole, the short par four, is really, you know, that bunker pattern. I can't remember which course. It's one of his drawings from the book where you've got those double diagonal bunker set up off of the tee and then a green that's kind of tucked sideways. So it really comes down to there are multiple question. Do I want to lay up short of all the bunkers and have a much longer shot into the green that's not receptive from a not great angle? Do I want to take on the first set of bunkers in a less challenging way and have, you know, poorer angle but closer? Or do I want to go for the whole thing? There are just so many layers in that hole. And I don't think we would have come up with something like that. And then same on 13, the par five. the tee shot there with the kind of string of bunkers down the center of it, dividing, again, asking big questions. I think Simpson, he was bold. He seemed like a bold person from what I've been able to read about him, but he was not shy as it relates to greens complexes, and he was not shy as it relates to bunker, adding bunkers, but making them, not doing it just to add them, but doing it because they ask good questions and they set up good strategies. And you talked about earlier about green speeds, and we obviously looked at his greens at Moorfontein and the little course as well, and we thought, well, we can't do that because of modern green speeds. So we did rein ourselves in a little bit, and we tended to focus more on slope versus undulation and getting greens. Yeah, there are some greens that have got plenty of undulation in them, but really focus more on pushing the envelope as it relates to slope, like getting whole pin positions and slopes that are 3.2, 3.5%, which we think is fine, but is kind of on the edge from a modern standpoint, and making those the predominant slopes in greens versus the predominant slopes being 1 or 2%.
One of the standout aspects of the new course is its choice to have 100% fescue. So talk us through that decision and why it's so unique to a course in France.
Yeah, I don't know that how many courses in France that have that, but I know that the genesis of it was Chris Haspel. He was the superintendent at Castle Stewart for a long period of time, is now hopefully will be the superintendent or project manager superintendent at Cool Links. I understand there's a chance again that that might be back, which would be amazing. But Chris, at Castle Stewart, he's a huge devotee of fescue. And I believe, I might be wrong, but I think he was superintendent of courses in Denmark, and I think he used fescue there as well. So he was comfortable and confident recommending that on the continent. And given the area that we're on, the sandy conditions of the soil, we felt like we could go ahead and pull that off. And it was going to provide us the best opportunity to have sort of bouncy, linksy turf, heathland type turf. And, we've had a few tough summers recently with the, water restrictions. And so some of the fairways have suffered just because, when they cut the water off, they're only letting us water greens and some tees. So they've had a few issues in the fairways, but it's all bounced back. A new superintendent is there, came from Moorfontein. So, Driss and Jack Laws are, director of golf, they're doing everything to present and take care and put it in the condition that we'd like to see it. But yeah, that whole thing started with Chris Haspel.
Fascinating stuff. You mentioned him there, Romain. We spent a bit of time with him when we were out there at the back end of the summer. He might be the coolest greenkeeper I think I've ever encountered. If he wasn't a greenkeeper, he'd be some sort of huge pinup model. There's a couple of holes that I really want to zone in on the new Gill. I think 15 sticks in my mind as just being this most incredible golf hole that I've never played a short four. I think the short fours really sort of nailed the new in terms of, like, there's a few of them and they really are probably some of the most memorable holes. But am I right in thinking you sort of also managed to put a few little touches in along the way? I want to say Jack told me the 14th, the bunker on the far left is, was a sort of a bit of a Pine Valley reimagination. Is that correct?
It is. Yeah, when we were building 14, we had this slope running off to the side and we thought, well, what could we put down there? It's a long par three. And so, yes, the I don't know if this is a children's show, but the Devil's A-hole at Pine Valley is an homage to our Philadelphia roots there. And then 15, we had laid out the bunkering sort of on plan, and it was another Simpson organization. And the rest of the golf hole came from the brilliant mind of my partner, Jim Wagner. I mean, lay board was one of the jobs that everybody wanted to go to. Right. It's obviously not incredibly difficult, but it's not easy to go from the United States to France and from a travel perspective. But every one of our guys wanted a piece of that job. They'd all heard about the patisserie and getting the croissants in the morning and the coffee and just the way Le Bord with the wine and the chin of food and just the beauty of it being in France. There's so many positives. So it was one of the few foreign projects we've worked on that Jim spent a lot of time and he was eager to get to France as well. So we were able to get, we had Neil Cameron ran the whole show for us. So he was the constant presence there, but every bunch of our guys were just hopping in and out. But Jim just, he said, I got an idea for this green complex, and that sort of bathtubby, semi-blind, very interesting, depending on what angle you want to hit going into it, what sort of club you want to hit going into it. It's Jim is one of the most brilliant designers I've ever been around. And when he gets something in his head, and he just went, I've said this before, he's almost like Seve. You used to hear these stories about when Seve would walk on the range, the sound that when he hit a ball, like all the other players were kind of looking around, what's Seve doing? When Jim gets this bug in his ear or gets like so focused on a hole or on shaping, everybody on the team's like, ooh, what's Jim doing? What's he, everybody wants to watch. And that 15th hole, Jim was absolutely in that zone, and we all enjoyed what he came up with.
Who was in the diggers on the piglet? I mean, I must confess, I got a real soft spot for par three courses. I used to play as a kid as a hotel down in Torquay in Devon called the Palace Hotel, and they had a par three course. I just love them. Anytime there's an opportunity to play them, it's my favorite thing. The par three course at Les Bourdes Wild Piglet is absolutely exceptional. I mean, it's 10 holes. It's about as much fun as I think you can have. It's so good. And the greens are completely funky. So for anyone who's not been, they're all named after, they've all got these crazy names. Crazy Bear, Baguette, Jelly Bean, Donut. They've got all these brilliant names. Yeah, just talk us through what that's like. And I suppose buried within maybe a little question about, could we see more of that in golf? Could we see more sort of short form golf like that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I hope the answer is yes, because we love doing them and they're a lot of fun. And to a certain degree, almost a little bit like the whiskey routing at a Hoopy, they're like the dessert. They're the reward for our guys who are working hard all year long, excuse me, to build a golf course, but they're getting a lot of the direction or some heavy editing from Jim and I, right? We're the ones out there talking through saying, hey, let's do this, let's try that. Or we're physically shaping them ourselves. So they don't, we like to let them have a certain degree of freedom, but they're not kind of going off on their own. But when we got to the end and it was like, all right, here you go, guys, divide it up. Whatever holes strike your fancy, whatever you've got an idea for. And part of the great thing, and this is something that Tom Doak taught me years and years ago, is that the best shapers and the best associates are guys who have studied and seen a lot. And Tom always talked to me about going to see stuff. Go see a golf course. You may not see anything good. You may just see one thing that's good, but you'll remember that one thing. And so all of our guys are really well-traveled, and they've seen a lot of great golf courses. They've seen a lot of funky golf courses. They've seen a lot of interesting golf holes. And so when you just tell them, hey, here you go, blank slate, do what you want, they're going to come up with some really cool and creative ideas. And a lot of the names were just inside jokes. There was one guy, the Baguette from that patisserie, was like, somebody would always get that. And so, it was Neil and Jaeger, Nicholas, Tanner, Jim, and myself. I'm sure I'm forgetting somebody. I apologize for that. But, it was just like, go to town. And so the guys all got to do at least two holes. I think I did one or two and Jim did one or two, and that was that. And so it was, again, that liberating thing, right? It's kind of like when we worked on the cradle at Pinehurst. There's no expectation for a score. There's no expectation for, shot values. It's just have fun and go out there and have a good time and figure out different ways to have a good time on a short golf course like that. So that's how that evolved. And then the Wild Piglet was just one of these kind of, there are a lot of boars, wild boars on property, and they were this big hunting estate. And so we came up with the idea for the new logo. So they haven't really used it very much yet, but the logo is the stag with the big full rack of antlers. And then the new course is just basically a spike with, two little tiny antlers on it. And then when Kevin Murphy, one of our associates, we said, well, what would you do with a wild piglet? So, well, what if we do a boar with its tusks being the antler, little antlers? So it was just a fun project, and Driss and Jack and those guys just said, go for it. And you know, every time I play it, it brings a smile to my face. And every time I talk to anybody who's been to Lay Board, it's not far into the conversation that they go, oh, I'm a wild piglet. You know, they get so excited about that.
If there was an expectation of score, it would quickly be removed when you get the blind tee shot in the piglet. Yeah. Who's responsible for a blind tee shot on a three?
I can't remember who that was. I want to say it might have been Jaeger, but I'm not sure.
Was that the thinking around the Alps or something? Was that the Himalayas rather?
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of it's the, you know, the Scotch broom, the broom, you know, it's a wall broom almost on top of mound. So yeah, everything conspires to make it more blind.
Yeah. It's a great little hole. I would just, I know we're coming to a close on this podcast, just touching on a hole. I think one of my favorite holes on the new course, I don't know if you can talk us through that fabulous little golf hole. Well, not little.
Yeah, you guys keep picking all the holes that Jim worked on. He must be really good at what he does.
Feedback's a gift, isn't it, Gil?
If you tell us what you worked on, we can work it into the conversation.
No. I worked on all the holes as well, but bits and pieces. But again, it was Jim's sort of concept of, hey, this is what we think we wanna do as it relates to that. And by the way, I'm so happy that it's great to talk about Jim. It really is. And because he's so responsible for the success that we enjoy. So it's kind of fun for me to be able to chat about what he does and how much he contributes. So it's one of those things where that hole, again, we knew going, or it was going to swing around the corner to the left. We had this landform there and it was, okay, what do we do? Do we drop that down so you can see, or do we leave it be blind? And how does that all work, you know, and tie things in? And then Jim just started talking about just dividing the fairway with different bunkers and giving you different ways to go. And then building this mound with the cross on it, because there are crosses out in the woods. And I don't know, the cross is still there, but it was like, if you want to go for the green, you're going to kind of pick out this little landmark in the landscape. And that's the route to go the hole, because it's not intuitive at all. Like you stand back, it's a shortish par five. You stand back in that fairway and you're thinking the hole plays much further to the right, but it really swings way back over to the left and you might not normally kind of pick that route. So he was trying to leave little nuggets of how you might play it. But it's something I think that's consistent with what we believe in as it relates to par fives, is that this, you know, every shot should ask a compelling question, but the second shot on par five should really be a thoughtful one. And the worst, in my mind, the worst shots in golf are, you know, long par fives where you're just making up ground. It's like, I can't get there, so I just hit whatever I can hit the farthest and knock it down there. We rarely, if ever, build a golf hole like that. So, you know, a lot of those questions on that second shot, again, came from the mind and the implementation of Jim when he was out there working on that hole.
Yeah, if you finish short right, with any sort of proximity to that green, you realize the second you get down on that green, you are dead. There's very little shot really. And you immediately think, God, I really should be 100 yards further back with a bit more club in my hand here. And it's,
It
sticks in your head where you look at the hole backwards and you're like, I see it. I've been duped here. So,
and that's another thing too. So we really feel big about is if we ever design a golf course and you play it for one time and you figured it out, then shame on us. We've done a bad job. You know, we want you, Sam, next time you go back there to be like, okay, now I'm not doing that again. And, you know, if you can learn something every time you go around, I think those are the best examples of golf architecture. And they're certainly the best examples of a members course. You know, if you don't want ever to build something that people are going to get bored after, you know, a handful of rounds, you want them to always be like, oh, I never noticed that, or I've never been here. And now I see why I don't ever want to be here again.
Well, Gil, the last time we spoke, we stole you away from your family on Thanksgiving. So hopefully it's not been such a hardship this time.
That's why it's been so hard getting him back on. So I'm joking, Gil.
No, you guys, and this is not gratuitous at all. You guys are great. You really do a great job covering golf and you talk about a lot of really interesting and important things. So I'm happy to be on with you. I really am.
No, it's a real pleasure, honestly.
He read the copy we sent over. That's good. I didn't know if you could read his writing. That'd be good. Gil, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat through some of these new build courses and some of the restorations. So enjoy your holiday and hopefully we'll catch again sometime soon.
All right. Thanks, Sam. Thanks, guys. Cheers.
Watch this.